Plaza, the Association for the Entertainment Technology Industry, and #WeMakeEvents have published a detailed global survey report on the current position and future recovery of the live events industry. Today, we're discussing the key findings and how it impacts you. I'm your host, Philip Hernandez, and this is In Park Tracks. For this discussion, I'm actually going to play you an excerpt from the March 6th episode of another show I host, Green Tagged, Theme Park in 30. Green Tagged is the industry professional's weekly dose of important theme park news in 30 minutes. I co-host Green Tagged with Scott Swenson, and if you don't get enough of me here, subscribe to Green Tagged. Okay, here's Scott and I discussing the key findings of this report. This comes to us courtesy of In Park Magazine, and I'm actually going to be reading excerpts of the summary of the report that In Park Magazine did. There's 1,948 respondents in over 40 countries, so it's a pretty good sample size of this live entertainment section. I've identified a few data points that I want to hone in on, and I think we'll take them one at a time. So 45% took on additional debt to survive the lockdowns. Freelancers are faring no better, with low earners growing in number and top earners dropping by 78%.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. First of all, I just want to clarify, this is Philip's summary of I just want to clarify that.
That is true.
We were all listening. Okay. So they took on additional debt to survive the lockdown. Again, makes total sense. You can either shut down or you can borrow money to stay open or stay active. It's probably more important. And I feel especially sorry. You know, we just talked about SeaWorld. The one thing that we've mentioned on the show before, but I just want people to remember, is when it comes to zoos and aquariums and any attraction that has an animal content, a living content to it, they don't just turn off like roller coasters. You can't just shut them down. You have to continue to maintain their care, maintain their water quality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I would guess that a big chunk of the attractions that took on that additional debt had to do so in order to keep their most important assets. And I would like to call them the either swimming or furry cast members alive during a lockdown. So it just totally makes sense. When it comes to freelancers, I am surprised by this number, quite honestly, because at least here in Florida, now granted, this was 21. You know, this was 21. My personal experience is I've seen that turn around. Yeah. And I have seen more and more, not just myself, but more and more freelancers like me who have either been brought onto projects as freelancers or have been tempted back into the corporate world as internal staff members for larger projects around the world. So I think that, you know, we were joking saying that, you know, 2021, gosh, the end of 21 was, you know, a decade ago. In reality, things are changing that quickly. Yes. So I think that recovery has already started. November, December of 21, I could see where there was some concern, but I think that has already started to make up for lost time.
Yeah. I agree with your point about that. It tracks with the conversations I have had with freelancers that are too busy right now, even to take on more work, you know, which we'll get to in a minute. Yes, Scott as well. But I also want to underline the thing that 45% took on additional debt to survive the lockdowns. To me, what that really illustrates, I think one way to look at it is saying, oh, look at how many people had to take on debt. The other way to look at it is to underscore that the impact has really been uneven in the industry, which is something that we've talked about quite a bit, but to just illustrate that the three chains we've talked about in their earnings reports here, you know, Disney, Universal, SeaWorld, being public companies, they have much better access to capital and they have much, you know, deeper pockets and whatnot. The smaller attractions that Scott mentioned really did, in order to keep animals and assets alive, they had to take on an extreme amount of debt, which ultimately getting to the other end of this, that puts the attractions on very different playing fields, where some have used the opportunity to build more assets and have deeper pockets and still now have access to more capital, whereas other attractions are still trying to even get back to a point where they don't have massive amount of debt. And they, you know, so it's very unequal. So all this is showing me is that it underscores how unequal it has been. So it's not like everyone has suffered equally is my big takeaway here. Nodding. Scott's nodding. Yes. So you can't hear that.
No, I think that's an interesting, I think it's a very interesting and logical take on the situation. I think that's assuming that there was an equitable distribution prior to the pandemic, which, you know, someone who owns an FEC does not have the same access and never has had the same access to anything that a Disney, a Universal, a SeaWorld Parks and Entertainment, Cedar Fair, Paramount Parks, any of those, they've never had that. So, and they also have had, they have different expectations and different ways of measuring success. It's interesting because I always look at it, I guess I'm just the eternal optimist. I just, when I was looking at it, I was thinking, you know, I think it's great that even during a pandemic time, there were lenders out there who felt that these organizations were valid enough to actually lend them money. Because let's face it, you know, banks are not known for being charitable organizations. They're out there to make a profit. So the fact that 45% took on additional debt, I kind of look at it from the opposite standpoint, and that is like 45% were able to get loans to take on additional debt, which shows that the financial world, at least to a certain degree, shows that or believes that there is a recovery, and I think we're seeing it now.
The next point on here is a shocking 94% of manufacturers are experiencing delays in components, resulting in many being forced to source new suppliers and redesign products. We have talked also about this, and in my reporting for the network, I've heard the same thing. I think my best example is from Zombie Skin saying that they expect the price of latex to double or triple in summer, and that's going to trickle down to their costs of makeup for actors for the Halloween and Christmas season when we have more actors in play. Also at Gantam, we can share that we've felt the impacts of this, and it's a very tricky balancing act. Paradoxically, even though we are smaller, again, to look at the smaller, larger example, even though we are smaller, we do operate our factory directly, you know, in China, and that gives us more direct control. So we have less pockets and less ability, larger ability like that, but we have more direct control over the individual pieces. So it makes it a tiny bit easier in some ways for us, but we are dealing with the same problems as well with delays in components and even sourcing components and trying to juggle all of these things together. And we have had to communicate that to buyers. So overall, creating a compounding problem, you know, which is kind of the mirroring the other problems we see, you know, with gas prices and with the overall inflation in the economy, where the delays in this causes inflation or causes delays or whatever. It causes strains in the supply chain, which then drives price up as demand, you know, can't be fulfilled, basically.
So I want to look at this from two basic standpoints. If you are a park or a company that is hiring someone to do something or provide something to you, recognize that the bids that you worked on, even 6 months ago, the cost of goods is no longer accurate. The timeline is no longer accurate. You can browbeat your vendors as much as you like, but that's not going to change the reality of the situation. So I ask the larger companies, and I've been really, really lucky because every single company that I am working for has been very understanding in regards to this. And we have then in turn, from a creative standpoint, from a vendor standpoint, we've had to go back and reevaluate the design process, to reevaluate the way things are being constructed, to reevaluate the magnitude of each element based on what is available. Now, the really smart folks, which I can't really claim that although I've been talking about it, I can't really claim that I've put it into practice as much as I probably should, are the ones who have the multiple supply chains, are the ones who have already put into practice what we talked about probably a year ago on this show, and what I was trained during my certification for post-crisis leadership is if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. So if you have multiple supply chains, you don't have to search for them when one of them dries up. This, beyond a shadow of a doubt, really reinforces that. And I think we're going to see that's more and more of a challenge moving forward. So on both sides, recognize. And by the way, vendors out there, if you are doing new quotes and new bids to install things and develop hard goods or even soft goods, I've got a costumer right now who has just lost fabric coming in. It's just disappeared. Because again, all of the delivery resources are being pushed beyond their limits. And it's the first time I have ever seen, from a supply standpoint, I've ever actually seen that one of the major delivery services, which I won't mention by name, has had a mechanical, they listed it specifically as a mechanical failure, which has made it so they're unable to deliver the product. I don't know what that means. I don't know whether the box fell into the gears and it got ground up. I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. But these are the kinds of things that we are seeing over and over and over again. So if you're doing new bids, extend your timelines. If you're making plans, make them sooner, early. Make sure that, you know, if you had, I would say add a month to your timelines if you're going to construct something new. Now, the flip side of that is you may be saying, oh, Scott, it's too late. That ship has sailed. So what do we do now? Well, then what you need to do is you need to get a good creative team to put together some new ideas and new ways of impacting your guests without utilizing those things you can't get. All right. Okay. And we all know staffing is a challenge, but you can always take something that was supposed to be animatronic and make it human. You can always take something that was supposed to be hard sculpt and make it soft sculpt. You can just, you know, I always say that my job as creative director, when I'm hired to do that for a project, my job is to usher the creative content from what was approved to what the guests see. And always there are going to be turns and twists in that pathway. So it's my job as a creative to come up with creative solutions to those problems. So be willing, be able to be more flexible on both sides of that desk there, both sides of that contract and agreement. And if you're taking everything internal, you know, make sure that you're looking at all options, because otherwise you're going to be spending too much or you're going to be running too late and you're going to have to, so you may have to find alternatives. That was a lot of words to say, just be aware that this is happening and plan for it the best you can.
Scott, you mentioned a few times in there the staffing thing. That also came up in this report, and I want to underscore that as well. In the lead up to the traditionally busy summer season, the live events industry is faced with a devastating skills shortage. 69% of companies report a lack of workers, particularly on-site roles such as engineers, technicians, crew, and riggers. These crucial shortages are forcing many to delay or cancel work, further losing revenue and opportunities. There is very little confidence that this picture will improve over the coming months, with the real risk of not meeting the increasing audience demand for live entertainment and cultural events throughout 2022. This is a key point. We have talked about this before. We have also seen this come up in other studies that are in tourism-related spaces that are not just theme parks, but the concept of demand shows every sign of going bananas again when we get into the summer and winter and holiday event of 2022. If that demand also hits this wall of the skill shortage, you're going to potentially see an inflation with staff prices again. It's going to become critical to retain the people that you do have, and especially high school. So that could be another really big piece that is coming into play. And I want to just echo what Scott said when it's like, sit down and make your plans. When you make the plan for thinking about, as Scott mentioned, shifting some of this stuff over because of lead times or component losses. Also make that plan considering what you will have to do to maintain the skill workers you have, or assuming you'll only get half of the people that you thought you were going to get. Again.
A half again. So now you're down to a quarter. at this point, so for many, many years, we have heard theme park chains say their greatest asset is their human assets, the people who work for them. Now they can't just say that. They actually have to mean it, and they actually have to pay for it. Because, you know, especially with these skilled laborers, there's only so many of those out there. Yeah. There's only so many of those out there, and they're going to be at a premium, and you're going to have to make certain that not only are they well compensated, and I'm not saying pay them more than they're worth, I'm saying make certain that they are fairly and well compensated, and you will have very little negotiation room when it comes to price, because they will have three other clients that are looking to hire them, and you'll get into a bidding war, and that's not going to work. So hopefully, if you've been wise in the past, you have built great relationships with these kinds of people, and you can continue to foster those relationships. And that, again, I'm not even talking about money at this point. Make sure they feel valued. Make sure that they are getting some extra, you know, those things that really don't matter to you. Like, yeah, we're going to give you free tickets to the park. That doesn't cost you a dime. You know, it's one of those situations where you need to make certain that you look at every possible way to compensate those people that you value, those people that you need to operate, and make it so that, as Philip said, make it so that people don't leave. You know, that's you're going to be your real challenge, because, again, you've got these skilled workers that have three or four different opportunities, and they, the moment something doesn't work in the first one they choose, they move on to the next. And by that time, the second one is already more desperate and they're going to pay them more. So it's one of those situations where those of you who have said for years, our greatest asset is our people or is our staff. Now you have to really, really defend that statement. And defend it in every way you can.
You might also, when you're rethinking about all this, need to rethink the business model for some of the things that you offer. You know, I think it will be increasingly difficult to have a business model that relies on the old model of employing people, where you just pay them the minimum you can get away with, just because, I don't know. I've had a lot of people tell me, and over the years in the industry, you know, that they want people that want to work there, that don't care about the money, you know, that want to work at the park because they believe in the park or believe in people or they think it's fun or whatever. You know, like, work is work ultimately. And I think that argument's not really going to fly, especially when you start to see compensation really outpace. So you're going to have to really rethink. I would say start off by this and say, sit down and say, does the business model for this event we're planning or this seasonal thing we're doing for Christmas, does it work if we have to pay all of our staff twice what we're paying them now?
I agree with those people who say, I want people who want to work there. But it's your responsibility as a park owner.
You have to make them
want
to work
there. You have to give them reasons to want to work there. And that has changed. You know, I've been in theme park now for years, and it has changed from working in a theme park as being the coolest job in town when you're in high school or in college to being, oh God, I can't get anything else. Well, I know XYZ Park is still hiring. And that's because internally it has changed. The mentality has changed. The number of, you know, I mean, even the stupid little things like the number of parties and outings and gatherings and perks has dropped significantly, because those are the things that are easy to cut on a spreadsheet. So make sure that, I agree with Philip 100%, make sure that you work all of these changes into your business model, but make sure that you work the changes into your business model that include making you the employer of choice for your target demographic audience. And only you will know what that means in your market. Unfortunately, it's a little trickier than just saying, I'm going to pay everybody twice as much. I think that's a great start, but I don't think that's going to be realistic for everybody. So you're going to have to figure out other options. I think pay is going to be a starting point. But if you truly believe that you want people who want to work for you, then you have to make an effort to make your place of business the place where people want to work. That's just not going to magically happen. You have to work to make that happen. So take that into consideration and make it part of your business plan, because it costs money, kids.
This has been In Park Tracks, the audio companion to In Park Magazine. For more information and to sign up for a free subscription, visit inparkmagazine.com/subscribe. In Park Tracks is a production of In Park Magazine. Our executive producers are Philip Hernandez and Martin Palicki. This episode was edited by me with post-production by David Swope. The discussion in today's episode was used with permission from Green Tagged Theme Park in 30, hosted by Scott Swenson and myself. Search for Green Tagged anywhere podcasts are found, or go to greentaggedshow.com to subscribe. The In Park staff includes Judith Rubin, Joe Kleiman, and Jordan Zuha.